Hi, and welcome back to Apology, a podcast about books and reading. Today's guest is the writer and collagist Lucy Sant. Her writing, which is some of my favorite nonfiction, blends history and memoir in truly fascinating ways. She's best known for her book, Low Life, Lures and Snares of Old New York. It's about the underworlds of mid-19th to early 20th century New York City, roughly 1840 to 1919, including gangs, geography, drugs, the theater, cops, prostitution, and more. If you're fascinated by cities, demimonds, and vice, this book will hit the spot for you quite effectively. Lucy's most recent book, Maybe the People Would Be the Times, is a compilation of essays that are autobiographical, critical, and historical. Nobody writes quite like Sant with such a mix of the personal and the researched. You really should check this book out and then go back and get her earlier book of essays, Kill All Your Darlings. There's also The Other Paris, a book that does for that city what Low Life did for New York, and The Factory of Facts, which covers her family history and more, from her Belgian birth to emigrating to New Jersey at five and beyond. But that barely begins to sum up the ambitions and the successes of this book. Lucy is also really adept at writing about photography. She teaches the history of photography at Bard, and her book Evidence, which focuses on crime photos from 1910s New York, is a masterclass in how to interpret and read images. Lucy writes with a special combination of learnedness, coolness, wit, and poetic style, and I couldn't be more pleased to have her as my guest. She is currently at work on a book about her recent gender transition, which I am really excited to read when it's ready. You can get a taste of that by Googling her name plus Vanity Fair, where a highly revelatory and quite moving piece was recently published. And so, yeah, without further preamble, please welcome Lucy Sant to the Apology Podcast. So, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading the Uncollected Essays of Elizabeth Hardwick. And weirdly, I've just started rereading a book I read when I was like 13, which is pretty shady, a book called The Morning of the Magicians by Louis Pauez and Jacques Bergier.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, it's this occult omnium gatherum that came out of this magazine called Planète in the early 60s. And I remember being like just wiped out by this book when I was 13. And then, you know, I learned a little bit about the world and started being dubious. But then I found it for a dollar at a used bookstore in my town. So I thought, hey, why not? And I've never read it in French, so I'm going to read it in French this time.
What's it about?
It's about everything. It's about reincarnation. It's about ESP. It's about extraterrestrial visitors. It's about the hollow ice caps, the whole nine yards, really.
How did you come across such a book when you were 13 years old?
When I was 13, it was just about the time that I was brought up very, very, very Roman Catholic, very intensely pious, my mother especially. And it all just like fell off me when I was 13, like snow off a tin roof. And as a consequence, I started picking around for like other forms of metaphysical satisfaction. And I used to go to this bookstore that stood for many decades in Lower Manhattan called Samuel Weiser's, which was a kind of, you know, occult and alternative spirituality or whatever kind of supermarket. I might have found it there, but it was actually, I mean, it was reprinted around then or printed in English or something, because it was a big time for that kind of stuff. You know, it was the immediate, like, well, I was going to say post-hippie, it was the late hippie era, you know, yeah. Around 69, 70, 71. You know, I joined through a listing in the Whole Earth catalog. I joined this free library by mail called the Luchas Trust Library, which would lend you like, you know, sometimes like 19th century books on all this stuff from the library of this dead mystic who was apparently very rich and whose library is still maintained to this day by a Wall Street law firm.
Wow.
And it turns out, you know, briefly, I was writing a biography of Lou Reed. That's shifted a bit, but it turns out Lou Reed was a member of Lucius Trust, not only subscribed to the library, but was involved in the meetings and was a devoted follower of this mystic, Alice Bailey.
Fascinating. Have you read anything by Alice Bailey?
I've tried.
No good?
You know, the thing is that, like, frankly, I'm a tourist. And when it comes to this kind of stuff, I like the anecdotes. I like the background. I like the details. But when it comes to metaphysical woohoo, I fall asleep within a page, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's true in general for me. I'm kind of wedded to the concrete, and abstraction just like knocks me right out.
Interesting. What that makes me wonder what kind of poetry you like to read.
Well, let's see. I mean, those French guys from, you know, Baudelaire, Rabelais, Lautréamont, Apollinaire, and then the New York School. You know, I studied with Kenneth Koch and David Shapiro. I'm still, you know, very much like, I feel very much like a renegade member of the third wave of the New York School or something like that.
Yeah, I could see that.
And, you know, I like the 17th century metaphysical poets. I love John Donne. I love Mayakovsky.
Yeah, big influence on Frank O'Hara.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I remember in one of your essays, you cited this moment when André Gide said that Victor Hugo was the greatest poet of the 19th century. And so I wanted to ask you, who's the greatest poet of the 20th century?
Ooh.
Is there one that sums up the times the way that Gide felt Hugo did?
I mean, I can't do greatest anything. I can only tell you what my favorites are, you know? That kind of hierarchy. The Beatles are better than the Rolling Stones. I mean, it just bores me. I'm sorry. So greatest poet. I mean, I might be tempted to say actually Frank O'Hara, or but then again, Frank O'Hara is fantastic. But what about Mandelstam? You know, what about Apollinaire, in fact? What about Garcia Lorca? You know, it's just there's no choosing a greatest.
Yeah. Do you think that Gide was doing something spurious in saying that about Victor Hugo?
No. I mean, because people always do that kind of thing. They're always doing their final four rankings of whatever it is.
What kind of house did you grow up in terms of books? What did your parents read?
Well, my mother did. I don't think my mother ever read an entire book in her life, actually. Both my parents were European working class, which means they left school at 14 to go to work. My father and apparently his father, who died 8 years before I was born, were both great readers. And in fact, when we came to the United States, my father packed a whole crate of books. So there were always these, you know, hundreds of books in the living room. And I had no idea where he got his tastes until I realized, you know, a lot of them were the bestsellers of 1949 to 1953, approximately. But he had a real ear too. And speaking of Victor Hugo, I mean, he used to like launch poetic tags in the middle of conversations. I had no idea what he was alluding to. And when I finally had a search engine at my disposal and could look them up, I discovered many of them were, in fact, Victor Hugo. Mm. But he read a lot of war books. He read a lot of things for style, and it's a style that I find a little windy, like very retrograde now. Well, his sister and her husband were small town news agents in Belgium. And, you know, there's no real American equivalent to this, but a news agency would handle magazine and newspaper subscriptions. And they'd also have a little shop in which they sold all kinds of printed matter, including paperbacks. And every year or so, they would send us a crate, like a big box of random reading material. And my father would immediately get rid of all the crime novels. So I gravitated to the crime novels. And, you know, I read a lot of great American crime novels in French for the first time. And then I don't know what age I realized that my father's taste and my taste diverged, but it was pretty early. So I did read war books. You know, when I started reading grown-up books when I was 11, and I started with war books because that was the house brand. But I didn't stay there for longer than a year or so. And then it became a matter of Happy Surprises found the library or used book sales. Or when I started reading the Rock Press, which was very, very important. I started probably even before I was in high school, because my local head shop got a magazine called Crawdaddy, which is very literate. Mm-hmm. And I would, you know, anything they recommended, I would read. So, you know, Paul Williams of Crawdaddy recommended V by that Thomas Pynchon. And lo and behold, it was on the shelves of my library. So, yeah.
But did your father get rid of the crime books on the basis of morality?
No, he was just not interested. In fact, almost everything about French culture that I love deeply, he found depressing, which is to say, those magical realist kind of movies of the 30s, the great chanteuses like Piaf, et cetera, he found all that utterly depressing. And I always thought it had something to do with some disillusionment of his youth. I always thought, you know, one of these days, my dad and I are going to have a real serious talk and he's going to come across with the real story of his life. But he got dementia and then died before that ever happened.
Mm. I wonder if he had some sorts of aspirations to like transcend his class, which could be very difficult.
Well, you know, he did. He wanted to be a writer, and he published one sketch, a kind of O. Henry-ish kind of little story in like 1948. And he signed it with the name he gave me at birth. So, you know, there was this real sense that he was passing on his aspirations to me.
Yeah, linking two of his creations, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Or not so much linking two of his creations as wanting me to pick up the torch that he had dropped.
Right, I see. Mm. Well, did he lived to see you become a writer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did he read your work?
He certainly did. Yeah. He read my first two books but the third one I actually wrote for him. It's a kind of memoir called The Factory of Facts. I wrote that for my dad, but he was no longer able to read by the time it was done.
Mm. As someone of Belgian extraction, I'm wondering if you can tell me anything about Belgian literature. Like, for example, who's one person I should read from the Belgian canon?
Mm. if there is one. The great 19th century novel is a book called Bruges la Morte, Bruges the Dead. And it's by, oh my God, I think it's by Verharen, but I just realized I can't remember who wrote that guy, or Rodenbach. One of the symbolists anyway. And it's from around 1900 or so. The thing about Belgian literature is that, well, either it's highly localized and hasn't been translated for that reason, and I can think of some great novels, but they would require so much explication. Mm. But also, Belgium is the forgotten country, you know. The poets who I'm very fond of, Louis Scutenaire above all, who generally, and I'm talking about the poets who were part of the Belgian surrealist movement, which is very different from the one in Paris, you know. Okay. They're great, but they're almost impossible to translate. And this is true of so much Belgian literature. It's impossible to translate because it's so deeply involved with wordplay that cannot be translated.
I see. How did the Belgian surrealists differ from the Paris surrealists?
Well, they weren't under the absolute command of André Breton, for one thing. And they tended to be much more serious. They tended to, the de facto head of the Belgian surrealists was Paul Nouget, who was a biochemist. I mean, they had serious jobs. They were not artsy dilettantes like so many of the Parisians were. And they're pursuing real arguments, you know, based on like Hegel. You know, they're often difficult to follow, but there's real meat there. And also, you know, real reverence to which they had in common with the Parisians.
So more cerebral in general.
Yeah.
Less frivolous than the Parisians.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And they had no sort of gang leader like André Breton was for...
Right, right. But he was more than a gang leader. He was Stalin, you know.
Right, he was a dictator.
Yeah.
You were educated by the Jesuits, is that right?
That's right.
What kind of role does reading play in that sort of education?
Big.
Yeah?
Let's see. Well, the school which I attended from 68 until 70, I was kicked out in the middle of my junior year, because I wasn't fond of school. But it was interesting because at that point we had two completely separate groups of teachers. There were the old Jesuits who wore cassocks and tend to be rather traditional in their focus. You know, my Greek teacher, it was like memorization. That's one of the reasons I did badly. It was strictly memorization. And I was... you know, too involved in hanging out. But, you know, he pronounced the word D-R-A-M-A, drama, which I don't know where he picked that one up. But anyway, so there was this real hidebound upper older generation. And then the younger generation were, you know, very hip and very politically active. It was the time of the Berrigan brothers, if you remember them.
And I don't. Who were they?
They were a pair of priests, one of them a Jesuit, who were very involved in the anti-war left, and they went to prison over and over again, et cetera. Mm. And so some of my teachers were involved with them. And I remember, you know, in theology class freshman year, we had to read Black Power by Stokely Carmichael, Soul on Ice by Aldrich Cleaver, on and on, you know, Man, Child, and the Promised Land. All these books, right away, were 13 years old, and we were reading these books in what was, at that time, almost an all-white school. It's since expanded quite a bit in that domain.
Was this in New Jersey?
No, this was in Manhattan.
Oh, so did you lived in Jersey, though, right?
Yeah, I commuted every day. It was an all-scholarship school. It still is. Everybody is admitted by an entrance exam. And then your education is free. It's the bequest of it. Well, I think they've run through the original founding money now, but it was the bequest of a mayor of New York in the early 1900s.
Mm. What about the reading of religious texts at school? How did that impact you, if at all, or did you find value in those things?
The only, you know, that's the funny thing. The only, because as I say, this theology class that we had was so much about social justice. The only religious texts I could think of that we read were the three volumes of C.S. Lewis's science fiction trilogy, Perelandra, Out of the Silent Planet, and this That Hideous Strength, which I thought were fun, but I kind of hated. It's been a long time. I don't really remember specifics all that well.
Yeah, I've never read those. Only the Narnia books.
Mm. I never read those.
I don't think you need to.
Mm. I know the plot.
Sorry?
I said I know the plot.
Yeah, there's a lion. He saves the world.
Right, and there's a wardrobe. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
When did you move to New York originally, as an adult, I mean, like, or as a young adult? What year was that?
72. I went to Columbia.
Okay. And you didn't finish Columbia, though, right?
No.
Yeah. What made you leave?
Well, I mean, my school career was completely checkered, and had it been up to me, I might have just dropped out altogether, or at least what I would have done was take a leave of absence for a few years and just live, and then, you know, go back to school after a while. But my parents wouldn't let me do that because they had no idea. I had a full scholarship to Columbia, and they were certain that if I took a leave of absence, it would forfeit the terms of my scholarship, which was not the case. And being feckless adolescent, post-adolescent, I just kind of slid out. I didn't make any conscious decision. I just would be very casual about attending classes and turning in assignments and stuff like that.
So it was there that you were taught by Kenneth Koch and David Shapiro?
Yes.
For those who don't know, two poets of the New York School.
Mm-hmm.
What were they like as teachers?
Well, Kenneth was fantastic. He was just one of my greatest teachers. David, too, although David was much more eccentric and personal. Kenneth was great about making the poetry of the past immediate to us. And his teaching method is the one that I adapted myself for my teaching, because I only ever took three poetry writing classes. I never took any other writing classes. So when I was actually teaching writing, I reverted to Kenneth's method, which was weekly assignments, many of them imitation exercises. I mean, and I realized, you know, I don't know why somebody teaching me style in writing when I was 18 seemed so natural and effortless and fluid. And my trying to teach style to other 18 to 22-year-olds, style was the big stumbling block. I mean, it was really hard.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. It's like everybody, you know, I would say, like, okay, tell a story and then tell it in the voice of a Southern preacher and then tell it in the voice of a telemarketer. And people would turn in basically three identical stories because they had no concept. They had no ear or something. I don't know. It's weird.
How did this, the assignments of being imitative work for you? That sounds like an interesting exercise.
I mean, if it worked for me, great. I mean, it expanded my palette enormously. You know, being able to do Rilke and William Carlos Williams and Ezra Pound, you know, et cetera. I mean, you really had to engage with a certain worldview, a certain rhythm, pacing, position with regard to the subject. All this stuff had to be refigured out every time. And it gave me tools that I still use.
And probably gave you new insights into the writers you were imitating as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So after Columbia, that's when you moved down to the East Village?
2 years later. I was, after I got out of Columbia, me and my roommates wanted to stick together. So we and there were no like apartments big enough for three people downtown that we could afford. So we stayed in the Upper West Side for a couple of years and witnessed the blackout of 77 and stuff like that.
What was that like for you?
It was hugely entertaining, actually.
In what way?
Well, I was living on 111th and Broadway. I was having dinner with some friends across Broadway. And then as we were finishing dessert, boom, all the lights go out. And the lights seemed to be out in the building. So I said goodbye to my friends and started walking home. And then Broadway was this river of people. And I was a little nervous at first. And I realized they didn't want to bother with me. But so I crossed, and then we were living on the 11th floor, and we hung out the window all night long. We had a radio that was, you know, keeping us up on the news, and we were watching the looting, watching cars with chains wrapped around their bumpers, tying it to the gates across storefronts and yanking them off and everybody going in and stealing stuff, which was, it was great fun to watch. We felt bad. I mean, some of our smaller local shopkeepers never recovered.
Mm. I wonder sometimes why the blackout of, was it 2003 or 2004? Remember that one?
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the city for that, but
it had a very different tenor. It was more like a big citywide drum circle, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And the one of 63 was kind of like, or 65, that was kind of like that too, actually. You know, all these great stories about strangers helping strangers. And, but the 70s, you know, were kind of an explosive time, you know, just the year a year or two before that, there had been the garbage strike, and in the poorer neighborhoods of New York, which were, that was a much bigger area than today, believe me, all the garbage was set on fire every night. So it was like this hallucinatory landscape. And the blackout seems just like a continuation of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm curious about your opinion of New York and its changes. There's this Frank O'Hara quote that I can only paraphrase that was sort of like about how the nature of New York has changed and that we can't lament it because that just makes us fogyish somehow. But I feel like there's been an elemental change that transcends that, that's for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
Probably since the market crash in 2008 or something like that.
Yeah,
when all the real estate speculation came in. I mean, how do you feel as somebody so linked to New York? What do you think of the city today?
Let's put it this way. You know, in the 90s, especially when I was had one foot out the door, I was spending half each year outside the city. And up to about, 2008, maybe that's it. I couldn't go into the city. I mean, I had to a lot, because I have gigs or whatever, and most of my friends still live there, but it just made me too angry to be there. And then I kind of decided that, I moved out of Manhattan in 92. I moved out of New York altogether in 2000. It's about time I realized that I can't take this personally anymore. I just have to deal with it, do my shit, enjoy what there is left to enjoy, and clear out when it bugs me. And that's kind of the attitude I have today. I mean, it's my New York, which I really think of as the New York I knew between 1968 and 1983, is so dead. It's as dead as New York in the 1920s or New York in 1890s. And there's no expectation it's going to come back anytime soon. So, and the gentrification was one thing. Gentrification was pretty bad. But now, it's all corporate. There's even the shop that looks like it was pulled together by two struggling art students is actually corporate, and that's the shtick under which they're operating. So, I hate it, but what can I do?
That's the way I feel too. I'm curious though as to why 1983 is your choice for a closing date of your New York.
Well, real estate speculation was ramping up at that point out of nowhere. I mean, I first really started noticing it in 82, because it took a few years for the Reagan years to really kick in. And number two, heroin and on the heels of AIDS, my social scene was getting wiped out. AIDS killed many, 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 many of my friends, and then heroin killed a bunch more, and the ones who didn't die were strung out, and bands were breaking up because people were stealing one another's equipment. Everything was going to shit. And then I want to say this as diplomatically as possible, because I can't really say what's on my mind, but I got into a relationship that I should not have gotten into, probably. Just leave it there.
Okay. That can be the death knell for an era, definitely.
Yeah.
So thinking about that time when you were on the Upper West and then moved to the Lower East, those sorts of years, do you remember any writers that were particularly important to you then?
Well, yeah. I mean, there wasn't much that was hot on the stands, brand new kind of stuff. I mean, the last time I remember that happening was when I discovered the works of Kathy Acker, which would have been about 1975 or 76. But so by 78, well, J.G. Ballard was probably the ruling literary guy in not just for me, but in my circle. Also Burroughs, who I sort of can't read at all anymore, but Burroughs was huge. And then, you know, all the old L'Outre-Amont, you know, I mean, reading a lot of the classics. And it was, you know, really at that point, it was a kind of crisis point for me in terms of literature, because I was out of school, knew I wanted to be a writer, kept trying to write a novel and then giving up. And I somehow knew that I had to find my own way in the world of letters. And I wasn't sure what that way would be. And I remember like writing all these pieces. I must have written a dozen pieces that I was going to send to the Village Voice, and then lost my nerve. I thought, these are people much more experienced than I, little did I know, right? They were all like my age and struggling in the same ways. But, you know, I didn't know that. I thought, if they're in print, they must be adults. And so my writing really didn't take off in a serious way until I went to work at the New York Review of Books, which was started in 1980.
Yeah, where you worked for Barbara Epstein.
That's right.
Was it being exposed to that kind of literary world that opened up your writing? I mean, like, when did you find nonfiction to be the realm that you wanted to be in?
It happened slowly. You know, first of all, I mean, here I was at this magazine, and I thought, you know, okay, I've been reading it every issue, cover to cover, for I think it was a year and a half by that point. I'm equipped to write a piece. I know how to write a piece for the New York Review. I knew that they'd sent out Albert Goldman's biography of Elvis Presley. They sent it out to three people who'd all turn it down. And I'd read an excerpt from it in Rolling Stone and just been outraged by what I read. So I took it home for the weekend surreptitiously and wrote my piece over the weekend, turned it on Monday, and they accepted it. That was the start of my professional literary career anyway. And then what happened, then for years, like for like 10 years, just about, I kept trying to write a novel, you know, over and over, iterations of more or less the same novel, and writing pieces for magazines, mostly criticism, and making a certain meager living at it. And then, what happened really is that actually was happened, well, within 10 years, I was wrong about 10 years, it was in 1988 that some publishers contacted me, the people who were starting the American branch of the British publisher Weidenfeld and Nicholson, and they'd recommended to me by somebody, we want you to write a book. What would you like to write a book about? And because I'd been thinking about it a lot, I blurted out, I'd like to write a history of the slums. I want to write about, you know, these tenements that I lived in and where they come from and all that. And also I had a memory of another one of these like fad books from when I was in college that everybody read was The Gangs of New York by Herbert Asbury. And the thing about that book is it's tremendously entertaining, but you don't know where he gets these stories. He doesn't explain them. Everything is fantastical and maybe a little dubious. So I thought I'll chase down the original stories. It'll probably be better, actually, than the legend it usually is. And it's turned out, no, they all dead-ended in the 19th century yellow press. They were all made up by somebody, you know. I mean, the most extravagant stories in Gangs of New York. While I was writing the book that eventually became Low Life, that Barbara loaded me up on the works of Edna Wilson. And I know some of his books, like To the Finland Station and The American Earthquake, and Patriotic Gore were huge influences on me, you know, in part, you know, making a book from books, making a book from other books, and, you know, kind of inspired amateurism. I wanted to write an approach to history without being a historian. And that Wilson helped me with as well. And also Lizzie Hardwick's essays were huge. That background gave me the equipment I needed to just, and eventually I was able to say to myself, no, even though I'm not writing fiction, I'm still writing literature. You know, it's just a different version of it. Right. But that's the origins of it.
I feel like Edmund Wilson doesn't get discussed nearly enough.
No.
How would you characterize his writing or his voice? How does he sound to you?
He can be maybe like today's literary consumer, today's youth especially, might find some of him a little hard going. I mean, if you start with his criticism, his reviews, I mean, he is operating from this Parnassian height. You know, he's looking down at genre fiction. He looks down at crime novels. He looks down at science fiction and delivers withering judgments and says, we are not part of the club. So when he's doing that, he's profoundly alienated. But the books I mentioned, I mean, To the Finland Station, which is a history of socialist thought that begins with the 18th century, and Patriotic Gore, which is an examination of the Civil War through printed sources, through diaries, letters, etc. Those two books in particular, and The American Earthquake, which is his, it's partly reportage, that one. It's his view of the United States in the early days of the Depression. Those three books, I mean, everybody should read them, I think. They're lucid as hell. They're grounded. They're fun. I mean, they're not things you have to grind through. They're engaging. Because he's got this reputation as like the ultimate literary Mandarin, probably people are not going to read those books on their own.
Yeah. I've also read that he was known to be sort of curmudgeonly in person.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, that famous card, you know, Edmund Wilson regrets he will not be able to review your book, write a blurb, attend your garden party, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
I remember that. And that he would mail that out in response to requests for blurbs and mm-hmm. things like that. Maybe you should make one of those.
No, actually, I'm a pushover. Well, I shouldn't say that, I guess, but I'm not as adamant. Let's put it that way.
Okay. What should people read by Elizabeth Hardwick? Just the collected essays, or is there a specific
collected book? Essays, and also her sort of novel, non-novel, Sleepless Nights.
I've never read that. What's it about?
It's about her youth. It's about her youth in New York in the late 40s. You know, it weaves between fiction, essay, memoir. You're never quite sure which aspect any specific thing about the book adheres to the most. There's a brilliant portrait of Billie Holiday in there, which I assigned to every single writing class I ever taught. It's a great book.
I want to go back to Barbara Epstein for a moment. I was wondering, since you had sort of a privileged window into her, what was she like as a reader? Was she able to read for pleasure? Time wise,
I think so. You know, I mean, yeah, she did. I mean, how much I don't know, but I mean, certainly, this is where I think of my own life. Like, how much reading do I do for pleasure? And I do read things just for no reason now and then, but so much of my reading, I think I'm reading it for pleasure, but really it connects to my work in some way or other. And I think that was the case with Barbara. You know, she was able to read and digest, you know, anything. And she certainly read the books by her friends, and her friends were many, and they wrote many books. And she was interesting, you know, because her literary purview, her literary background was so interestingly broad. So she, you know, she could tell me to read Edmund Wilson. She could tell me to read Henry James. She was always after me to read Henry James, just so I still haven't done much of, I confess. But also, you know, she went to college with Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery, Kenneth Koch, Harry Matthews, all those people. So she was also, you know, kind of avant-garde too in that particular early New York school way. You know, she wasn't really about genre fiction or populist literature, but, you know, she could be persuaded. I wrote stuff for her about that, and you know, she was willing to entertain it. And I'm remembering now, Barbara and I had one fight in the 25 years that she was my editor. And it was the only piece I ever withdrew for consideration, which was my review of Greil Marcus's Lipstick Traces, which is a book about punk and the situationists and all that. And I think, I mean, I didn't keep my review, but I think it was probably pretty jejun. In the course of this fight, we kept both throwing around the word culture. And it dawned on me in the middle of this that we were using culture in extremely different ways, because for her, culture meant Auden, Balanchine, Stravinsky. And for me, culture meant ostations, hot dog stands, shooting galleries, you know.
Right.
It's like two radically different conceptions of culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that I don't like at least Auden and Stravinsky, you know, I do, but
Balanchine's, you know, good too.
Balanchine's probably good too, but I've never seen any. So
Were you ever a ballet goer?
No.
You know, for those who don't know, I guess we should say who Barbara Epstein was. I just realized that it's a certain audience that knows her. So she was the co-founding editor of the New York Review of Books,
and she went to what was then Radcliffe, you know, incorporated into Harvard, and went to work right away for the publishing industry and scored her first coup when she was like, I think she'd been working in publishing for like a year, when she picked a book out of the slush pile, and it was the Diary of Anne Frank, and she pushed for it to be translated and edited, or I mean, I guess it was translated. She pushed for it to be published, and of course, it was a huge bestseller and made her career.
Is it true that you worked at the Strand?
I did.
What was that like? When was that?
That was my first job after college. And 76 to 79, I worked there. And it was awesome. I mean, first of all, they handed me my own department, which I'd been there for like 2 months. And they said, let's have you take care of the paperbacks. Because, you know, paperbacks were still not taken very seriously in used book world in those days. And it was, I mean, I had the time of my life. I mean, every time they acquire a library, they throw me anything that wasn't a hardcover book. So I got all the paperbacks. I also got people's snapshots and magazines and brochures, you know, everything that still constitutes the root of my the collection of images I use when I make collages to this day. Also, the Strand in those days, I mean, one of the reasons, I mean, I'd been a customer at the Strand since I was in high school, but I also knew that it was like really hip place. And indeed, I mean, all these bands were founded. I met Lux Interior of the Cramps, who worked alongside him for the week he was there. And then all these no wave bands, you know, there were at least two or three contortions working there, one member of Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, a bunch of, that was the aesthetic, the no wave aesthetic of that time, could probably be found in, you know, greatest concentration in the basement of the Strand, circa 1978, 79. I mean, it was great because, you know, at the time it was, you know, it was a shit job, but you could pay your rent and feed yourself and buy used clothes and, you know, have a little money left over to go partying. It was possible to do that then, conveniently located downtown. And you had all these people who might be transients. You had people coming in, you know, they were like working their way around. You know, they'd just been in Baltimore for a year. They were doing New York for a while. They were going to go on to Cincinnati. I remember a guy like who had his own version of it, which is that he worked as a friend for years, but he moved every month because he only lived in SRO hotels when they were still a thing. And he decided, I think I'd like to live in Kipps Bay this year. So, you know, and, you know, so he had a lot of interesting eccentrics working there.
Yeah.
Oh, the other, when I stalled back there in my memories, I remember the name of the other No Wave band. It was DNA, which contributed, you know, two of the great members of DNA worked at the Strand. And I put out a magazine from the Strand. And, you know, it was the center of real, like, intellectual and artistic exchange. You know, it was that agora thing, you know, the thing that's so lacking in today's world, except online, you know?
Yeah. A marketplace of ideas.
Yeah.
Were you able to get a lot of books, too? I mean, it must have been crazy.
Especially since I was the paperback department. If I saw something I really wanted, I'd mark it a quarter, no matter what it was, you know?
I was going to say, it must have been a dream being able to just rifle through paperback libraries as they came in.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned finding photographs in some of those books, and you've written a lot about photographs. And I wonder, I don't know, can we call that a genre? There's people like Michael Lessie, too. Are there enough people to call it that? I don't know, but...
Maybe, I don't know.
How did you get started on writing about photos? What do you remember the first piece and what inspired you to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been interested in photographs since I was a teenager. And, you know, for a while, I thought that it might be a possible career for me when I was a teenager. But I never wrote about photographs until I wrote my book, Evidence, which was just a side effect or outgrowth of my book, Low Life. These were books people... Those were pictures I found while doing picture research for Low Life. And then once I published that book, which apparently had some kind of effect among photographers and photography people, I started getting all kinds of work. And I've been writing about photography ever since. Not as much as I once did, but quite a lot since. And the other thing I taught, by the way, I'm still a member of Bard College for a couple of years, but I'm basically retired from teaching. Then I was teaching writing in the spring, but in the fall I teach history of photography.
What are some texts that you teach in the history of photography class?
That's the problem. There aren't many.
No.
You know, I feel like I have to throw in some text so they know that it's a college course, but I'm allergic to academic writing. So I give them, you know, I mean, sure, there's Roland Barthes and Susan Sontag, but every undergraduate has already read those by the time they come to me, so I never assign those.
Right.
You know, I assigned, you know, a little bit of James Agee over here, a little bit of Alan Trachtenberg over there. There's some great, I mean, something I've only discovered in the last 10 years, really, the works of a French writer, kind of a bad novelist named Pierre Macorlan, who wrote amazing stuff about photography, which hasn't been translated. So I did my own translation and teach that. You know, it's hit or miss. I felt sheepish about it always, but I found myself assigning myself as reading because, you know, yeah. But, you know, my classes were not so much about reading. They were about looking.
You were a book critic for a while, is that right?
Yeah.
At New York Magazine?
Yeah. By the way, I've been a book critic, a film critic, a photography critic. I was a crime critic for Spy.
A what critic?
Crime.
Oh, crime.
I was a music critic. I've been every kind of critic almost, except theater and dance and food. Yeah, so I was book critic for New York Magazine for one unhappy year, yeah.
It was unhappy. Why was that?
Because I wanted to write about the books that I wanted to write about, and they wanted me to write about the books that their readers were curious about, and we did not necessarily coincide.
Yeah. What year was it?
Sometime in the late 90s, like 97, something like that.
I wonder what they would have been asking you to read at that point. Just the mass market novels, the big literary novels.
Big literary novels. I mean, I remember I reviewed Mason and Dixon by Thomas Pynchon. I reviewed The Ice Storm by Rick Moody, his biography of Simenon. It was, you know, stuff was pretty, not too bad, but it wasn't doing what they wanted it to do. That's all. Mm.
Did you ever pan anything?
I don't think, you know, I mean, I wrote, you know, like I had that job for a year, meaning I probably wrote like 8 pieces. And usually, I mean, I only pan things when I don't, you know, I enjoy writing pans, of course, because who doesn't? But I try not to indulge in that too often because it's just too easy a thing to do, to be mean. I can be really mean, and it's too much of a temptation to just be an asshole. And so I only do a pan if it's something that's been assigned to me and I had no say in getting this cultural production, whatever it was, or if it's something that I think should be called out, that it's like misleading in some way. Because by and large, I mean, my philosophy as a critic is I want to judge things on their own merits, not according to some scale I carry on my head. You know, is this book, record, movie, whatever, doing what it set out to do? And, you know, is that worth doing? But mostly, you know, is it living it up to its own promises?
So take it away from any context other than itself.
Well, I mean, not any context, but it's just I don't impose, I try not to impose criteria that may be arbitrary, artificial. I mean, good writing, yeah, of course. You know, the writing that is, that I always judge outside of whatever they may be thinking, the authors. But in terms of the premises of a book, what it wants to do, I'm more interested in, does it carry out its mission rather than does it carry out the mission I might have wished it had?
It's interesting because as the critic, you have to decide what you believe the mission is before you can ask that question, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's usually evident within the first 10 pages.
When you say you're capable of being mean, do you think you could be cutting with words? You're capable of writing polemics?
I'm capable of writing really mean takedowns, yeah.
Love to read one of those one day.
Sure.
If I ask you for an essential book, an essential Paris book, what comes to mind?
The book everybody should read is The Invention of Paris by Eric Hazan, Hazan. It's the best, like, it's a personal history, but it's a real history. And it's very geographically based. It's like, what happened in this quarter mile here? And so it jumps back and forth in time, but he really covers the waterfront. And it's just a wonderful book.
Mm.
It's available in English.
Well, what about the same question for New York?
That's much tougher.
That's hard,
right? No, it's not actually, because Gotham by Mike Wallace and I don't remember who the other guy is now.
I've never read that. How much, what time, what span of time does it cover?
Well, the second volume is supposed to be coming out. Maybe it already had. No, I think I would have heard about it if it had. The second volume should be out one of these days, but the first volume covers up to, I think, 1914, something like that.
Mm. For some reason, I don't know why, I wanted to ask you if Los Angeles interests you at all.
It does, very much so. You know, there's Mike Davis, Rainer Banham.
Right, City of Quartz, Mike Davis is great.
Right. And it's, you know, it's a fascinating place. I wish I knew more about it. Would I write an LA book myself? No, because I know too many LA people. Because I've been asked many, many, many times, like, are you ever going to do another city book after New York and Paris? And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And I realized I kind of feel like LA is other people's territory. So I can't bust in on that turf. Same thing with Chicago. Of course, I busted into other people's terms with Paris, but whatever. If I could, if I had world enough in time and I were to get myself thoroughly schooled in Spanish, I would love to do Mexico City, but I'm too old.
What do you like about Mexico City?
It's chaos. It's surrealism come to life. It's the wildest city in the whole wide world.
I've never been.
Oh my God, it's crazy. It's so great. Okay, let me give you a Mexico City snapshot here. So I'm just walking down this big boulevard called Reforma. And Reforma is one of the big boulevards in Mexico City that has a big traffic island in the middle of it. And this traffic island has like a monument at each corner, every block. And so I'm walking down and I see, look over at the traffic island and realize there's a whole line for going on for blocks and blocks, naked people, naked men, two rows of naked men facing each other, going all the way down. And at the monuments on the corners, it's all the women who are up against the monuments and they're all naked. Turned out it was a protest by peasants from Veracruz whose land had been stolen. And so this is going on one side of the street. And on the sidewalk that I'm on, suddenly I see like eight guys dressed like Zorro. And they're promoting, this was some years back, obviously, they're promoting Isabel Allende's novel about Zorro. And so, you know, they give, it's you can't make this shit up.
I really enjoyed your essay on Lovecraft. And I'm wondering for somebody who's getting into him, who else a Lovecraft fan should read that they haven't read?
Boy, that's a tough one, because that was, you know, I was assigned Lovecraft and I said, sure. I'd been a big fan when I was 13 or 14 years old and hadn't really read him since. Nor, I mean, you know, and back then when I was in my early teens, I did read a lot of fantasy. I read Lord Dunsany. I read Arthur Machen. I read Clark Ashton Smith, all those people. And I haven't read any of them in over, you know, 50 years now. And I suspect I probably wouldn't like them very much, but, you know, I don't think in fantastic. I think I may think in surrealist ways, but not in fantastical ways.
What's the distinction?
Well, the surrealist way is you realize that all the fantastical stuff is in your subconscious. The fantastical, you know, you see it out in the world. And you know, I'm too much of a commie to see it that way, really.
So magical realism doesn't appeal to you?
No. With exceptions, there are some, yeah.
Right, okay. Like what?
Well, the Master and Margarita by Bulgakov, that comes to mind, but there was something more recent. I can't think of what it is now. Let's skip it.
Okay. I've always wanted to ask you this, since I think I know the field pretty well. Who is an underappreciated writer of hard-boiled fiction? There must be some people that I haven't read yet that I need to.
I can't think of the guy, name of the guy who wrote Screaming Mimi. Do you know that book?
No, I don't know that.
Okay. Frederick Brown. Frederick Brown.
What is Screaming Mimi about?
Oh, it's been a long time since I read it, so I can't possibly give you the plot, but it's in the vein of somebody like David Goodis, except that it doesn't have Goodis's quite level of despair, maybe.
That's something I love about Goodis, for sure.
Mm-hmm. See, I haven't really read in the hard-boiled department very much except French stuff. And I wish they'd translate some more of the French stuff. You know, there's lots and lots and lots of great of French hard-boiled fiction, even though they all look to the Americans, but it's, you know, it's something I do on and off really. When I, these days, when I need an infusion of crime writing, I just pick up another Simenon because it's inexhaustible.
How much reading do you do at the research stage of writing? You know, even the shorter essays are rife with citations, you know?
Yeah.
So are you always reading in a sort of directed way? Or
I mean, a lot of it, yeah. I mean, if I'm setting out on a project, I'll read everything relevant with special attention given to the outliers. And I've got a large home library, as you can imagine. So, you know, whenever a subject comes up, I'm wandering through the shelves, picking off anything that looks relevant. And then I remember things too. And suddenly in the middle of a piece, oh, right, this reminds me of blah. Yeah, I do quite a lot of reading. And it's a different kind of reading, of course, when you're reading specifically for use in a text. It's a certain kind of like speed reading, diagonal reading that I don't use when I'm reading for pleasure, but, you know, a lot of absorption of text.
Can you remember a book that was an outlier that was important to Lowlife?
Gee, I mean, I don't remember any specific outliers there. I think, you know, one thing about Lowlife is that, I mean, for years, people would come up to me and say, I love Lowlife. It's such a great book. And I'd say something stupid like, no, it isn't. And one of the reasons that it always bothered, Lowlife always bothered me, was because I didn't know how to do research at the time. So I feel like, you know, I didn't do a tenth of the research I might have done if I'd known what I was about at that time.
Which methods of research did you not know about?
You know, one thing I have a book coming out this August about, well, it's a very local interest. It's about the reservoir, New York City reservoir system, which isn't kind of in my backyard. And for that, I fell completely in love with newspaper archives, just reading newspapers. You know, I like to read a lot of peripheral stuff. I mean, if I have a single greatest fascination in my life, it's the conjunction of time and place. You know, whatever, Budapest 1813, you know, Tokyo 1957, whatever, this conjunction. And for that, you know, I mean, anything is fair game. Railroad timetable, classified ads, you know, just all the stuff that you read that is kind of impregnated, imbued with the essence of an era. And I love doing that. I love kind of vacuuming up an ambiance, a zeitgeist from this paraliterature.
Is there an era that you've written about that you feel like you would like to live in?
Yeah, it's funny. I sometimes have lunch with Peter Lamborn Wilson. You know who he is?
Yeah.
AKA Hakim Bey.
Hakim Bey. He wrote Temporary Autonomous Zone.
Right. And so we often, that's the kind of parlor game we have, this like, which era would you stop at, you know? And I think the consensus, I think for me, I mean, okay, very, very large asterisk, an asterisk that covers 3/4 of the screen next to this. But in a lot of ways, the era, the 10 years before World War One, you know, you had movies, you had recorded music, things that I need. But other than that, it was still very, very analog, obviously. People did not generally have cars, but took trains. You know, of course, this is mirroring my own childhood where nobody had cars or televisions or telephones or central heating. You know, that was my childhood in Belgium. So it's probably based partly on that. But, you know, but at the same time, I mean, I can complain all I want about the digital world and how much it's reduced the physical world. You know, I miss the materiality of life as it used to be before the mid-90s. But on the other hand, I recognize that so much of what I do and so much of who I am, especially with regard to this transition I've been undergoing, would not have been possible before the digital era.
Mm-hmm. How does being in the digital era impact your transition, your gender transition?
No, because it lifted the veil of ignorance in which we all dwelt. You know, there's really, you know, before the internet, if you wanted knowledge about transgender matters, you were pretty much, unless you happen to have some special connection with the medical practice, like if you knew people at Johns Hopkins or something. Otherwise, it was rumor, it was hearsay, it was popular culture. And really, you know, there's so much I just had no way of knowing.
Mm.
And also knowing that there are other people like you around and blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, of you community.
Yeah.
Was there any reading that was helpful for you or was solace for you or as you transitioned? Or how do you see gender as a reader?
That's an interesting question. You know, my now erstwhile partner, one of the very first things she said to me when I made my announcement was, "So are you going to start writing fiction now?" I have to admit that in a lot of ways, I'm the same person I've ever been, but in other ways, I have changed radically. And one of them is my relationship to humans, because that old thing of hiding out, I did, hiding out in plain sight often enough, avoiding people, avoiding social life, avoiding confiding in people, all that stuff got washed away because my secret is out. I have nothing to hide. So I can talk to anybody at any time for any reason. And that's made me real social in a way that I never was before, ever. So, I mean, I figure that the fruits of that will start showing up in my writing. You know, I don't know when, where, how, why. I am writing my trans memoir, if you want to call it that, now. Yeah. But as far as deeper effects, remains to be seen. And as far as books that gave me solace, you know, weirdly, I you know, it's because I started reading 10 tons of trans literature right away. And the book that I found most moving is I think it's like the earliest, I mean, it's not the earliest trans novel, certainly, but the earliest like modern trans novel, I think, just about. It's a book from 1966, British book, called I Want What I Want by a man named Jeff Brown. And it's beautifully written. It's a kind of kitchen sink novel, you know, like Room at the Top or something like that. Only it's about wanting to change genders. And it's, you know, people today will take exception to it because of course she kills herself at the end, you know, stuff like that. But it's, I think it's beautifully written and deeply insightful into, you know, some of the metaphysical aspects of changing genders, for example.
What do you mean by metaphysical?
Spiritual.
Spiritual.
You know, I avoid the use, I guess I avoid the use of the word spiritual because it can mean so many wrong things. So I tend to say metaphysical, which is, you know, well, that's the book that Aristotle wrote after he wrote physics, and he wrote metaphysics, and that's all that means.
Thanks, Lucy, for your time and generosity in speaking with me. It was a joy. This episode was recorded by me from my home in Los Angeles while Lucy was at hers in upstate New York. It was post-produced and edited by Justin Geller in Philadelphia and facilitated by Lars Kreslins, also in Philadelphia. The music, as you might have recognized, is Bach, which has been arranged and performed by Cyrus Garmani in Los Angeles. If you're enjoying this podcast, I'd be eternally grateful if you would subscribe, like, and maybe even review it. I'm going to take a brief hiatus now, but we'll return soon, probably this summer, with more episodes. In the meantime, you can find my magazine, also called Apology, at apologymagazine.com. Thanks a lot for listening.